The Regrettable Adventures of Horace Whitley. Episode 2, Bloodthirsty Book. My dearest Albertina, it was with the greatest joy that I received your written response to my initial correspondence, although I suggest henceforth you allow Egberto to transcribe your thoughts for you, as a great number of your sentences appear to trail off the page, most likely due to your not having any eyeballs. Nonetheless, from what I was able to piece together, I was most heartened upon learning that you were able to hear the sound of my voice without regurgitating your latest meal. Baby steps, dear sister, baby steps. At this time, I would very much like to regale you with the tale of a truly remarkable occurrence of which I was both witness and participant. I ask you to bear with me, for I promise it was an important step on the path which led to your eyes melting out of their sockets. Do you recall Mother's former accordion instructor, Thugsiel Keppelthorn? If not, you are most fortunate, as Mother was a dreadful student to the point of driving our dear Corgi Tiddles to leap to his death from a third-floor window. Oh, Mother always claimed he was pushed, but I promise you, he jumped. Anyway, while the accordion was his first love, Mr. Keppelthorn earned his living selling used, rare, and generally dangerous tomes. Mostly arcane in origin, though he always reserved a shelf in the back for his many volumes of German circus porn. It is in his capacity as bookstore owner that I bring Maestro Keppelthorn into our tale. Specifically, because not long after I returned from my life-altering adventure in Venice with Bri-Bri, old Kipper, as I lovingly called him, died. Quite horribly, I've been told. Something involving a number of wild geese pecking out his liver. Or perhaps it was his spleen. The details are fuzzy. In the final coroner's report simply stated the man had succumbed to a rare and unidentifiable condition known as death. What matters is that he died, and Mother received an invitation to his funeral. Of course, her agoraphobia prohibited her from attending, so I went in her stead. It was a lovely service, although personally I would have gone with a closed casket. When it was over, I was approached by old Kipper's granddaughter, Miss Sandra Keppelthorn, who asked if I had any plans for the evening. I naturally assumed she was suggesting we indulge in some inappropriately carnal activity, and so told her I was quite available. She snuffed out my flickering infatuation by instead enlisting my help in boxing up her grandfather's shop. Which is how I came to find myself standing in the center of Ye Olde Book Bazaar in the middle of the night, holding the Codex of Putrid, Fetid, Grotesque, and Otherwise Unimaginable Horrors, Volume 1. A rather loathsome tome, covered in undecipherable characters and a thick layer of either dust or blood, which had been found in a secret compartment above a weather-worn stucco ceiling tile. The fact that it was fastened by a padlock resembling a frowning skull, and appeared to be made entirely out of human skin, was simply icing on the proverbial cake. There were four of us there that fateful evening. Aside from myself and the lovely Miss Keppelthorn, there was a swarthy-looking gentleman named Opal, who worked as Ye Olde Book Bazaar's designated late-night shelver, due to his unfortunate inability to adjust his biorhythms to the time difference between the shop and his native Qatar. And also there was a rather bountiful woman named Belladonna Sprigg, who had, it seemed, worked the past 14 years as old Kipper's janitor, accountant, and gal Friday. Miss Sprigg had been a tumultuous, insufferable wreck from the moment we met, and I had assumed the rivulets of moisture constantly running down the rotund woman's face were due to seasonal allergies. In time, however, I came to the off-putting realization that she had most likely been Thuziel's lover. How the 92-year-old man had won the heart, soul, and corset of the 35-year-old woman, quite possibly when she had begun working for him at the age of 21, was both beyond my understanding and, quite frankly, far more than I could stomach. Opal claimed the book in my hands was evil, and that it often screamed during the night. He suggested we destroy it at once. I posited that while this was a prudent suggestion, it could be argued that opening the book and discovering what forbidden secrets had been etched into its damnable pages was if not equally prudent, certainly far more interesting. Miss Sprigg voted with me, as she could not stand the thought of destroying anything once owned by her beloved Thuzee, while Miss Kepplethorne agreed with Opal for the simple reason that she wanted to be done with all this and back home as soon as possible. Therefore, by a vote of 3-2, the decision was made to open the book. I made the executive decision that my vote should count twice, seeing as how I was the only one in the room who had ever previously opened a portal into an alternate dimension of chaos and horror. Of course, to open the book, we needed to find the key to the frowning skull. I explained that it would most likely be covered in hellish and arcane symbols, and quite possibly coated with a thin sheen of blood. Miss Sprigg immediately opened her bodice and produced said key, which had been hanging from a chain around her neck and nestled securely in her bosom. She said it had been a love gift from Thuzee. I threw up a little bit in my mouth, and was not the only one present to do so. I set the book down on the counter and took the key from Miss Sprigg's greasy clutches. I was about to insert it into the skull's nasal cavity when I remembered that it was not uncommon for truly terrible things to happen to the unwary explorer who dared to dabble with eldritch volumes of lore, and so I handed the key to Opal instead. The man reluctantly inserted the key into the frowning skull, gave it an expert twist, and was rewarded not with a deadly spray of acid or ghostly apparition of black magic, but a simple click, which I, personally, found to be a bit anticlimactic. He then flipped the book open to a random page, which, as it turned out, was not a very good idea. A flash of horrific dark light burst forth from the volume, instantly searing Opal's pupils, much as the acid recently thrown into your face did to yours, dear sister. Then, before the suddenly blind individual could so much as register the horror that had befallen upon him, a ghastly form unfolded itself from the page with a piercing shriek, wrapped three tentacles around the man's neck, and slammed his head onto the table with enough force to shatter his nose with a comical-sounding snap. From there, the unholy demon bounded up to the ceiling and quickly scuttled away into the depths of the bookstore, looking like nothing less than a large dark volleyball adorned with multiple putrid grey tentacles. A moment later came silence. Apart from the hysterical screams of agony coming from Opal, of course. "Good heavens!" I exclaimed. "Is everyone all right? Apart from Opal?" "My eyes!" screamed the poor man. "My eyes!" "Are exceedingly disturbing to look at. Would you mind terribly dropping your head back down onto the table?" He complied. "Please note, dear Al, that your own condition, while identical to his, is not nearly as disturbing. You wear your empty eye sockets with grace and dignity. Anyway, the three of us, currently not writhing in agony, stood in mute horror as our minds attempted to fully digest what had just unfolded. Opal remained screaming, but we were able to tune him out for the most part. We had unleashed a horror from beyond time and space. This is generally a bad thing, and I felt we had a responsibility to return said horror to said realm before it escaped the confines of ye old book bazaar and commenced mutilating all of mankind."
"But how do we do that?" asked Sandra. "How do you stop pure evil?"
I explained that it really depended on the nature of the evil, although heavy weaponry was often helpful. Belladonna then suggested that perhaps we ought to turn another page of the book. I vehemently disagreed, but before I could state my objections, Opal reached out and flipped to the next page of the unholy volume. He then instantly screamed in even greater agony than before, as what could only be described as a large set of purple lips rose from the page and took a bite out of his face. The rest of us stood watching, unable to halt the man's torment, until the lips finished their unholy snack and popped themselves from the pages of the book to fly off into yet another corner of the cramped store. So now there were two of the little buggers. Deciding enough was enough, I pried the almost certainly dead Opal's fingers from the book and closed the volume. "Right, now, about that heavy weaponry I mentioned, any thoughts?"
"Thuzee kept the shotgun behind the front counter to discourage returns," offered Belladonna.
"Now we're talking." I made my way behind the indicated counter and collected old Kipper's firearm. Just holding the weapon in my hands gave me the confidence that we would be able to survive this apocalyptic encounter. Or, at the very least, I would. I suggested the ladies wander into the stacks and make a lot of noise, in hoping that the monstrosities would become spooked and run toward me and my shotgun. They told me I could stuff it, and we were at an impasse. Just then, one of the horrors, the lips one, scuttled across the ceiling above our heads. Acting on instinct, I raised the shotgun and fired, blasting a goodly-sized hole in the lower lip. I was about to congratulate myself on an excellent shot when we witnessed the injury instantly heal itself. The lips blew a raspberry at us and zipped away. I handed the weapon to Miss Sprigg to reload and put on my thinking cap. Shooting the monster, while satisfying, had not improved our situation. I suggested we consider leaving the store and running for our lives. Miss Sprigg handed me the reloaded shotgun and suggested we attempt to soothe the creature with a gentle sing-along. Opal did not make a suggestion, as he remained quite dead. Even were he alive, the dismantled state of his face made it highly unlikely we would have understood any suggestion he offered. It was Sandra who set us on the path to salvation.
"Do you think there's a volume 2?"
We all immediately looked to the store's designated late-night shelver for the answer, then looked away as he was both unsettling to look at and dead.
"This was the only book hidden in the ceiling," said Belladonna. "I can't think of any other place Thuzi would have kept another book."
"Perhaps the bookshelves?" I offered. We began a search, moving through the stacks in a human clump, with the two ladies quickly scanning the shelves while I pointed the shotgun at the ceiling. At first, it seemed the two horrors from beyond time and space would prove minor impediments as they kept their distance. Alas, the peace was short-lived. Uttering a sound which would curdle spilt blood, the volleyball-like thing thrust a tentacle toward us. I fired, scoring another direct hit on the thing and causing it to lurch away for a moment. The wound then magically healed itself and the blasted thing returned. I cried out a warning, dropped the empty shotgun, grabbed a random volume off the shelf, and hurled it up at the horrid thing. It proved a far better distraction than the shotgun, as the creature took a moment to open the book and rip out all the pages, swiftly turning them into confetti, which it then dropped onto our heads as if we were enjoying a ticker-tape parade of evil. The lips-like horror slithered its way over, and I tossed a book in its direction. It caught the book in its mouth and chewed it into pulp. Then the two horrors attacked us once again. Luckily, by this time, Sandra had found the cursed volume we were searching for, and we retreated once again into the center of the shop and the sight of poor Opal's passing. The things of terror and madness followed, but Miss Sprigg and I kept them occupied with a steady diet of rare and priceless books to eat and or otherwise destroy. The Codex of Putrid, Fetid, Grotesque, and Otherwise Unimaginable Horrors, Volume 2, was a thin, wispy little thing, more pamphlet than codex. As it was not in any way locked, it gave the impression of being far less dangerous than its elder cousin. Sandra opened it and was surprised to find, of all things, easily legible words. It seemed Volume 2 had been written much later than Volume 1, and not long after the authors of Volume 2 mistakenly opened Volume 1 and proceeded to, for the most part, die horribly. With Belladonna and myself pulling more books off the shelves and offering them up for sacrifice, Sandra had a go at our new find. It read more as a, "For God's sake, don't try this at home," message than anything with an actual narrative, but what it lacked in action and adventure, it made up for in easy-to-explain instructions on how to banish any ungodly horrors the reader may have inadvertently released. The procedure was relatively simple and involved one person reading a counterspell aloud from Volume 2, while another held Volume 1 open. There were, however, two conditions that needed to be met. First, the volume of evil needed to be locked back up and then unlocked with the key entering through the right eye socket of the frowning skull rather than the nasal passage. That was simple enough. Second, the person holding Volume 1 open during the ritual had to be the same person who had unlocked it in the first place. This was more than a bit concerning, seeing as how that person was Opal, and he was still dead. Belladonna finished tossing a selection of books on the impure and often sultry rituals of southwestern United States at the horrors, and continued our defense by pulling down a number of volumes pertaining to llamas and the evil inherent within, as Sandra and I debated our next course of action. It was obvious that she would read the passage from Volume 2, obvious in that she currently held the book in her hands and was not letting it go. It fell to me, then, to figure out how to have Opal perform his needed duties without actually being alive. And I must say, dear sister, you would have been proud of your brother had you been there to witness my stroke of genius, assuming you still had your eyes, of course. Acting in the manner of the great puppeteers of old, I pulled the corpse into a standing position and manipulated its hands and fingers like they were flesh-covered chopsticks. Together, Opal and I removed the key from the book and reinserted it into the right eye socket. After a bit of back and forth with Sandra over whether she meant my right or Opal's right or the book's right, in the end we had a 50-50 chance and got lucky. And here, Al, is where this tale intersects with your own. Using Opal's cold and increasingly stiff fingers, I opened the troublesome volume. Happily, we were not visited by a third entity of insanity. Rather, what poured forth from those demonic pages was a swirling purple light, which I recognized at once, for it was into this same swirling light that Delmont Thoughtburg III had vanished all those years ago. Was this book, then, another portal into poor Minty's alternate dimension? I shoved the question aside for the moment, as there were beasts of cruelty and horror to banish. As Belladonna was forced to dip into the shelves of German circus porn for ammunition, I used Opal's cold, dead hands to open the tome wide. At once, Sandra screamed the incantation into the void. There was a terrible flash of light and power and energy, and then all at once the pulsating purple glow turned itself into some sort of cosmic vacuum. The horrors we had unleashed were drawn within against their will, and the world was safe once again. I took a moment to cherish what we had accomplished. This is unfortunate, as it meant I did not immediately close the book, and thus the vacuum of evil continued its work and managed to suck in the lovely Miss Kepplethorne before I thought to slam the pages closed. All was silence. I dropped both the book and Opal's dead body to the floor. Belladonna sagged, exhausted, and I saw that one of the horrors, probably the lips, had torn a chunk of her hair out on its way back to its home dimension. I put my mind to work on how I could use this cursed book to rescue both my old school chum and the young Miss Kepplethorne from their tragic fates. The question became moot, however, when Miss Sprigg stepped up with the shotgun she had reloaded when I wasn't looking and fired point-blank into the center of the book, utterly incinerating it. This particular portal was now most certainly closed. However, my mind was now alive with possibilities. Minty was not a lost cause. I knew what I had to do. But that is a tale for another time. For now, dear sister, I shall leave you to your sponge baths and medications. Do give my best to Egberto, and thank him for me for agreeing to stay on and nurse you back to a semblance of normality without demanding a raise in salary.
Your loving brother, Horace Whitley.